All right, we'll call case number 2, which is 062866, Powers versus Richards. Morning, Mr. Baker.
Morning, Your Honor.
I hope your wife is well.
She came home from the hospital 2 days before Christmas, and she's doing very well. And I would like to thank the court for its indulgence back in October. It was most appreciated. May it please the court, I am appearing this morning on behalf of Robert Powers. This case arises out of Mr. Powers' discharge from employment with the Illinois Civil Service Commission, where he served as its executive secretary back in May of 2003. The district court granted summary judgment. Mr. Powers had two separate claims before the district court. I would like, as an initial matter, to address his First Amendment claim. He claimed that he was the victim of a discharge from employment based upon partisan political considerations. And within the context of the summary judgment proceeding, the only issue before the court was whether his position was exempt from First Amendment protections. And I think the starting point for my argument should be the position that the defendants advanced before the district court. In their motion for summary judgment, they stated, and I quote, and I'm referring to page A33 of the supplemental appendix of Mr. Powers' brief. It says, the new administration was constitutionally permitted to make employment decisions regarding plaintiff's position if it chose, based upon plaintiff's political affiliation. And the question in this case is, did Mr. Powers' position require political loyalty to the governor of the state of Illinois so that he could be removed based upon his political persuasion?
You know, I've been wondering, if political affiliation is irrelevant to the position of executive secretary of the commission, then why is there a requirement that no more than 3 of the 5 commissioners be members of the same party? Is that majority of 3 always the same party as the governor?
I believe under the statute, commissioners serve staggered terms. So depending upon whose term came up during a pending administration, it could vary back and forth and could be such that a majority of the commissioners were not of his political persuasion.
Uh-huh.
The defendant's position in this case begins and ends with the functions of his job. And they claim that he had policy-making functions, and therefore, under this court's holding in Riley versus Blagojevich, that his position is not protected by the First Amendment. Now, I'm going to make two concessions. First concession is Mr. Powers' position was a policy-making position. We've never claimed otherwise. And secondly, if the only pertinent analysis to his position is whether it had policy-making responsibilities, then the district court's analysis is correct and we should lose on appeal. But our position is that there are two core legal principles which predate the facts and the occurrence in this case, which are instructive. The first is, in the Finkel case and its progeny, both the Supreme Court and this court have held that in determining whether a position is exempt from First Amendment protections, you don't look only at the label of whether it's a policymaker or whether it's confidential. Instead, you inquire, has the government demonstrated that political affiliation is an appropriate requirement for the position, given the relevant facts in the case?
Well, What is his best evidence that he was fired because of party affiliation? Because the defendants have evidence that he was fired for certain illegal actions he allegedly took when he worked briefly for CMS. Is there any evidence in the record that the reason given was pretextual, that it was not the real reason for the termination?
In the summary judgment record, there is none. And the reason for it is the defendants never claimed that there was inadequate evidence of a political connection in the summary judgment proceeding. So we never got to that point. It was never raised or presented to the district court. The issue instead was whether he could be terminated for political consideration. So the record is silent on that point. Our view is, and then the second legal principle that I think is instructive here is that in any type of analysis as to whether a position is exempt from First Amendment protection under the Elrod Bronte line of cases, it is the government, the defendants, who bear the burden of showing why political considerations are an appropriate factor. And their analysis in this case was limited only to the policy-making functions of his job. I'm going to go out on a limb here, which is something that I was instructed you should never do in appellate advocacy. But despite that admonition, I'm going to say this. Of all the positions, of all the thousands of positions in state government, I can think of no position which is less worthy of political considerations being tied to it than the executive director of the Illinois Civil Service Commission. And I say that for multiple reasons. I think the first reason is to go back and examine the role of the commission in state government. It was created to adjudicate and make decisions concerning the application of the Illinois Personnel Code. And the legislative purpose of that particular statute is to develop personnel principles.
What was the position he held during this original four-year term employment?
He was a deputy director of the Illinois Department of Central Management Services.
A political appointee.
I beg your pardon?
A political appointee.
Correct.
And then he resigns, and a few days later is appointed to a new four-year term.
Are you referring to Mr. Powers?
Yes.
No, that's not correct. The four-year term issue involved other employees in state government, not to Mr. Powers' position. Mr. Powers applied to become the executive director of the commission.
But wait, just get all this underbrush out of the way. This looks like an effort to continue your employment. You're a political appointee, and you want to continue your employment under the new administration and immunize yourself from being discharged. Is that wrong?
That if you're referring to Mr. Powers, you're dead wrong, Your Honor. This was not a political appointment when he became executive director of the Civil Service Commission. He had to
The original appointment he had, a four-year term.
He was never a four-year term appointee, Your Honor.
What was he before
he served when Governor Ryan took office. Mr. Powers was a member of his staff,
right,
who served at the will of the governor. Toward the end of the Ryan administration, he became employed as the deputy director or assistant director of the Department of Central Management Services. And my understanding, in that position, he had no term appointment. He served again at the will of the governor. He left the Department of Central Management Services and became executive secretary of the Civil Service Commission. And to become the executive secretary, he had to go through a competitive process against other candidates to secure that position. It was not a political appointment. It would be much the same as anyone else in state government covered by the personnel code going through a competitive process to secure his position.
In other words, he had to take tests, he had to what else? Interviews? I'm trying to figure out.
My understanding is he had to secure a grade for the position. And I'm not sure whether you actually have to take a test or whether that can be done on the basis of your of the materials in your application. And then you go through a competitive interview process where a number of candidates are interviewed and the commission presumably selected the most qualified candidate. Going back to my argument, Your Honors, the commission is a bipartisan body. And in its website, we refer to this in our brief, it indicates that it is a bipartisan, independent watchdog. Those are its words. And its job is to ensure that personnel matters are determined and decided not based upon political considerations or loyalty to any constitutional officer, but instead based upon merit principles. And the members of the commission have to be individuals who are adherents to the merit policies. That's what the statute says.
Do they have to have the party identification? When you talk about bipartisan, usually means that you are one or the other.
There are five members of the commission. The statute says that no more than three can be of any political party.
So you have to be identified before you get the job.
I'm not sure. I suspect in a practical matter,
it's going to be a vacancy that, and it's got to be at least the other party.
Correct.
Party. So I've been away from that a long time, but that's at least what you have to.
I believe that's correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
So had he had this job for 2 years, and then the new administration came in, there probably wouldn't have been much issue. He was already occupying a place. I think part of the problem was the way he got in here.
Well, I don't know that that should be a problem. There's nothing in the record in this case to suggest that he received the appointment based upon his political affiliation. Nothing in the record. I think the curious thing about the timing is that he was eliminated shortly after the Blagojevich administration came into office. That has some curiosity feature.
But did his job, did he facilitate these four-year term employees from getting out from under that restriction so that they could stay in their jobs longer?
I guess it depends upon your definition of facilitate. He had a very minor role. His role was limited to contacting a personnel specialist at the Department of Central Management Service, a woman named Deborah Hensley, and ask if under the personnel rules this transaction could be done. She did some investigation, came back and said, yes, it could be done, and it had been done in previous administrations. He reported that information to his superiors. That was the first prong of his involvement. The second prong of his involvement was that the Director of Central Management Services, although he approved the transactions, did not want to sign his name, and we don't know why, but he did not want to sign his name to the personal transaction form.
That's a Schwartz guy?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. And Director Schwartz authorized the governor's office to sign the forms on his behalf. And Powers' boss instructed Powers to sign the forms. When he signed the forms, Powers understood that Director Schwartz had approved these transactions. That was the extent of his involvement in that particular transaction.
I want to ask you sort of a bottom line question, and it's this. A governor who had a political enemy in this particular post, could that governor be hampered in implementing the legitimate goals of a of the governor's party in state government?
Yes. And if that occurred, the executive secretary would be abusing his position, mm-hmm. and under the personnel code could be discharged for cause. The whole notion of holding this position is not that you're a political adherent either for or against the governor, but at least within the context of performing your job duties, you're a political neutral. You don't make decisions based upon partisan political considerations. So if Mr. Powers had made his decisions in a way that he said, as a card-carrying Republican, I'm going to go out to get this administration, and therefore I'm going to find reasons to make decisions that are harmful to them, then he could be terminated for cause. And that's how the General Assembly contemplated it when it created the personnel code.
I'm going to have to...
Time flies when you're having fun, Your Honor.
I'll give you a minute for rebuttal.
Thank you very much.
And Mr. Ellis, if you think you need an extra minute, we'll give you that extra minute, too.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Assistant Attorney General Carl Elitz, Your Honors. I'm appearing on behalf of two groups of defendants. The first group is Governor Blagojevich and two members of his staff. The other group are members of the Civil Service Commission. They're in slightly different positions, Your Honors. My governor clients, as I'm calling them, are going to concede for the purposes of the summary judgment motion only, and I want to emphasize that point, only for the summary judgment motion, that they were terminating Mr. or wanted to see Mr. Powers terminated because of his political affiliation. In the real world, they're going to vigorously defend that if it ever gets to an administrative hearing or if it's going to go to a further hearing. Their position is that he was terminated, of course, because he signed these forms improperly, and that was a fraud on the state. And so that's why he was terminated. But at the summary judgment stage, it came clear that the other side was arguing that we had done this improper thing, and it's our view that it's as a matter of law, it's not something that can support a cause of action under Section 1983. So with that preface, the question becomes whether Mr. Powers held a job or had a position in state government that where political loyalty was a valid qualification for his position. And this is not something that's new. This court has examined this question in many cases now. The test is, does the position authorize directly or indirectly meaningful input into decision-making on issues where there could be principal disagreement on the implementation of state policy? That's the test that the Seventh Circuit has followed in these cases in deciding whether or not a position is or is not exempt from the First Amendment protections. Those protections are discussed in Elrod and Bronte, the Supreme Court's decisions, where the court talked about balancing the need to protect employees' rights, their First Amendment political rights, against the government's need to effectively use the government's position to advance democratic goals that are the agenda of the incoming governor. Mr. Baker has said that the position of the executive director of the Civil Service Commission is perhaps the model of type of job that should not be subject to political motivation. But that's not the case. We have from the Bronte decision a discussion by the U.S. Supreme Court as to the type of job that would fall outside, that would be a policymaker's position like we have at issue here, but that would fall outside this requirement. This is an unusual type of job. And that's the job in Bronte was the example given was of a university football coach who was in charge of the state's football program. He would certainly have policy-making authority because he would be in charge of the athletic department. He would be able to hire and fire people. That would put him in a policymaker's position. But no one could suggest that a football coach had any political concerns that were appropriate for considering whether he should or should not maintain his job. Mr. Powers is in a different place, a very different place. This is a highly political state agency where politics matter a great deal. The Civil Service Commission oversees 57,000 Illinois employees. The governor, of course, is very concerned that the Civil Service Commission, in doing its job, do it in such a way as to protect the people of the state. And if there is, and if that doesn't happen, then the people of the state are obviously going to look to the governor's office. Why are state employees abusing their duties? Why do we have fraud in the state government? These are the questions that the Civil Service Commission ultimately has to handle. So the governor is very interested in what happens in the Civil Service Commission. Now, there are state protections that are provided to the executive director. Mr. Baker's correct about that. Those protections are not anchored in federal law. They're not anchored in the Constitution. They're extra things that the state has provided to this position. In a Section 1983 action, the question is whether there's been a violation of state law or the Constitution. If the governor has violated those state protections in trying to see Mr. Baker terminated, I'm sorry, not Mr. Baker, Mr. Powers terminated, then that may violate state law, and Mr. Baker can represent his client in a proceeding and argue that Mr. Powers was terminated unlawfully. But that would not change the nature of the federal inquiry about whether Mr. Powers' rights were violated.
I just want to ask this before it goes out of my mind. Powers had complained that the commissioners made their minds up before his pre-termination hearing when they empowered the chair to fire him. Could the chair have terminated Powers without a vote of the majority of the commissioners? Who has the authority to fire him?
The decision to fire Mr. Powers was made initially by the full commission, but Mr. Powers was entitled to a pre-deprivation hearing. So they weren't able to implement that question without giving Mr. Powers the opportunity to that proceeding. Mr. Richards, who was the chairman at the time, was authorized by the commission to meet with Mr. Powers to discuss the charges, and in fact he was given written notice of what the charges would be and some opportunity to prepare for the meeting. And at the meeting, he told Mr. Richards that the charges were not something that should result in his termination. Mr. Richards had the authority of the commission when he conducted this meeting.
They had empowered him to make the decision.
Yes, Your Honor. And
is that unusual?
No, Your Honor, it's not unusual. And I cited cases in my brief, Loudermill out of the Sixth Circuit, the remand of the Supreme Court's decision. There's also a Ninth Circuit case. There's a case cited in Loudermill in the First, the Fourth, and the Eleventh Circuits. These cases all suggest that the ultimate hiring and firing authority does not need to be the one at the pre-deprivation hearing.
No right to a face-to-face meeting is what.
No, not with the ultimate decision maker. You have a right to meet with someone who has authority. But Mr. Richards, when there was this pre-deprivation, had that authority. So this is a question, Your Honors, that goes to my other group of defendants, my civil service clients. But that question is, I think, a good one and one we've addressed in our brief.
Yeah, I think it's sort of intertwined, it's kind of here. But
moving, if I could, to the other side of this case, the due process claim against the Civil Service Commission members. There's two parts here, and Your Honor just touched on the first part, the pre-deprivation hearing. Under the law, Mr. Powers was entitled to notice an opportunity to rebut the charges to someone who had authority to make a decision, and that was Mr. Richards. With regard to the other part of his argument, I think I've answered that question, by the way. I think there should not be much concern with the court that Mr. Powers didn't receive a valid pre-deprivation. He also argues that he didn't receive a viable or valid post-deprivation. Yes. It's our position on that question that this is simply a forfeited claim. It's double forfeited. It was not raised in the second amended complaint that Mr. Powers filed. But also, and I think this is the cleanest and simplest way of disposing of these claims, after Judge Scott dismissed these and said that the defendants, my Civil Service Commission defendants, had judicial immunity, it was not raised and argued in Mr. Baker's brief. So we don't have anything to challenge the district court's finding that the Civil Service Commission defendants had judicial immunity. It's forfeited. Now, he argues, he goes on and argues that that the hearing was unfair in some way, that he didn't have a neutral ALJ. He argues that the commission members themselves had were biased against him. But these are questions that should simply not be considered, given the fact that he hasn't tried to argue around the bar of judicial immunity that was held up against him below. Now, if the court does reach those questions, the ALJ in this case was chosen by the commission members because there was no other person who could decide this case. Mr. Powers had been a member of the commission, and he knew the ALJs, and it simply wasn't going to work to let one of the ALJs who had served under him then judge Mr. Powers. And so they brought in an outside ALJ, Mr. Trapp. Under the rules of the commission, Judge Trapp's qualifications to serve, whether he was improperly biased, could have been raised and argued at that hearing. It would have been brought up. It would be in the record. There was no arguments at all made below that Judge Trapp was an improper hearing officer, other than to say that he hadn't been picked by a joint agreement, which was not really what Mr. Baker's brief argues now. It's not the fact that he wasn't picked by joint agreement. He argues that Commissioner Trapp was irregular and so therefore shouldn't have, I guess, been an appropriate hearing officer. The main argument he makes, though, with regard to his post-deprivation hearing is that the commission members themselves shouldn't have been able to sit and judge his termination since they were the ones who were responsible for terminating him. That argument, really, I don't think goes anywhere because there's no requirement in, under Illinois law that the commission can't do that, and there's no suggestion that an ultimate decision maker necessarily can't make a decision on a question where there has been some involvement. Sometimes that's just what has to happen because who else can make this decision? Under Illinois law, the commissioners are the ones who will pass on the final, at the commission stage, will make the decision. And if the commissioners can't do it, there's no one who it can be delegated to. Sometimes I know that happens in appeals in front of courts where the court has to make the decision. There really isn't anyone else who can make the decision. So the court recognizes there's a possible conflict, acknowledges it, but then goes ahead and does it because there's no other party to do it. It's a rule of necessity. I think that covers everything. I want to make sure that if there's any questions.
Well, it's just, I want to be clear the as far as how he got the position in the first place, and then what's your position there? Because there seemed to be sort of a scheme.
Yes.
I don't know whether he's directly or indirectly involved in that.
Mr. Baker has told you this morning that Mr. Powers got this position in the Civil Service Commission through an open bidding process. I don't know if that's true or not. I did talk to my client yesterday about it, and he informed me that Mr. Powers is a veteran, and so in applying for that job in the Civil Service Commission, he had a preference over everyone else. I object to Mr. Baker saying he was the most qualified. I don't know if he was or he wasn't, but I know that he was awarded the job in great measure because he was qualified and was a veteran. So, but he was the position of Civil Service Director is not one that is appointed by the governor. The members of the commission themselves make the decision. If the governor has been able to secure a majority on the board, then the director's position is filled, then that would be filled likely with a member of the same party as the governor.
So he was appointed by the then standing commission.
Yes.
And he was released by the then standing commission.
At the time he was released, yes.
And how many different, what was the difference in the makeup?
As I, Commissioner Richards was a Republican. Ewell was a Democrat.
No, I mean the difference between when he was appointed and when he was released.
I don't know if there was a change in the commission's membership or not, Your Honor.
How much, how long was he on the commission?
Your Honor, I don't know the answer to that either, although I don't think it was a great deal of time because he was working at CMS in 2002.
Yeah, well, chances are it's the same people.
Yes.
Because it's supposedly a four-year position for each member, isn't it?
I believe it is. It might be six, Your Honor. I'm not sure if it's four or six.
Well, I thought it was four, but whatever it is, it's more than a few months.
Yes.
And unless someone else was appointed in the interim and left, it would be the same people.
Yes. If there are no further questions, I'd ask that the...
Just how many Republicans, how many Democrats?
It's always 3-2, Your Honor.
I know, but... I know it's always 3-2, but at the time.
I think at the time it was 3 Republicans and 2 Democrats.
That would be likely.
Yeah.
All right, Your Honors, if there are no further questions, I'd ask that the court affirm the district court's grant of summary judgment.
Thank you, Mr. Eaton. Now we gave you an extra minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I don't want to spend all my time on this, but I believe there was one change in membership of the commission at a time proximate to Mr. Powers' termination.
How long did he serve?
I believe, if recollection serves me correctly, he served from October of 2002 until May of 2003. I would like to, and I'm probably not even going to get through this, address one point. Mr. Ellett says this is a 1983 action, and accordingly, Mr. Powers' protections under the personnel code, although relevant to the personnel code, are totally irrelevant to this case. And I disagree in this sense. Mr. Powers' position is a creature of statute. And this court in Lohorn versus Michael, which is cited in our reply brief, indicated that applying the Elrod Bronte exception, a court may appropriately consider and give great weight to how a state legislature characterizes a position. And it's clear here that the legislature, in requiring that people be appointed to that position based upon merit, and only being removed from that position based upon cause and having no connection between the tenure on that position and the tenure of a sitting governor, seems to speak legions to the proposition that the General Assembly felt political allegiance to the governor was a completely irrelevant consideration to that position. I've used up more of my time, unless the court has questions.
Thank you very much. Thanks to Mr. Ellett. Thanks to Mr. Baker. The case will be taken under advisement.